Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, also historic Urbana, Illinois, on this day of sort of strange weather again in central Illinois on April 30, 2006, the final day of April. Today we have for us on the air one of the guests we've had many times in the past, and one of our favorite guests here on Media Matters, Janine Jackson, the Program Director of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the Media Watch Group that's been around for 20 years and does close analysis of the media system and press coverage. She'll be here to talk about and grade and evaluate the nature of journalism today and some of the big questions in the media that we face and we discuss in the show. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
This is an historic moment for the committee. We're about to break with the entire history of the Internet. Everyone should understand that.
The Commerce Committee of the House of Representatives did not take Congressman Ed Markey's warning seriously. On April 26th, the committee voted to approve the woefully misnamed Communications Opportunity Promotion and Enhancement Act, which stands to transform the Internet from the vibrant, open, democratic forum for communication that it is today into a virtually privatized network where access to online content and services will be controlled by the nation's largest phone and cable companies. Congressman Markey of Massachusetts attempted to amend the bill by adding a provision that would guarantee the principle of network neutrality.
Should there be an ability on the part of AT&T, on the ability of Verizon or Bell South, to discriminate against hundreds or thousands of smaller companies, smaller individuals? The answer is they will be allowed to after this bill passes. So why are they all showing up now as if they should own it? Because they think they can.
Unfortunately, the amendment was narrowly voted down, and the COPE Act now heads to the House floor for a final vote. But the fight to preserve Internet freedom is not over. The Save the Internet Coalition, which was launched less than 2 weeks ago, has already attracted an impressive and still growing array of members, ranging from the American Library Association to the Parents Television Council. Coalition partner Craig Fields, representing the 300,000-member Gun Owners of America, says keeping the Internet open to everyone transcends political boundaries.
In a very, very strange situation, what we have is the necessity of government intervention to ensure a free marketplace of ideas. Whenever you see people on the far left and the far right joining together about something Congress is getting ready to do, it's been my experience that what Congress is getting ready to do is basically un-American.
Since the Save the Internet Coalition was launched, more than 250,000 people have signed its petition urging Congress to guarantee freedom of speech online. This first skirmish did not go the people's way, but it's just one in a series that's expected to take place on Capitol Hill over the course of this spring. You can find out more information about the campaign to preserve Internet freedom online at savetheinternet.com.
Although legislation to strangle Internet freedom is likely to pass the House, it's not likely to happen without a fight. The day before the Commerce Committee marked up the COPE Act, the House Judiciary Committee's Task Force on Telecom and Antitrust held its own hearing on network neutrality. It's looking at the issue from an antitrust perspective, given that the phone and cable companies have an effective duopoly over the provision of broadband access in America. Columbia Law Professor Timothy Wu says the nation's communications infrastructure faced a similar crisis nearly 150 years ago.
In the 1860s, the telegraph companies, which were also a monopoly, Western Union, signed an exclusive deal with Associated Press that only allowed Associated Press to be carried over the wires. They didn't actually block other companies, they just discriminated against other companies. That, in turn, led to a news monopoly in the late 19th century, which was a threat not only to American business and competition, but a threat to American democracy.
The large phone and cable companies repeated their mantra that they will not, quote, block, impair, or degrade access to online content. But Paul Meisner, Vice President of Global Public Policy for Amazon.com, calls that claim a bald-faced lie.
If that's the case, who on earth would pay for prioritization that doesn't thereby relatively degrade the competitor's content? The fact of the matter is, the way the internet works is that if you prioritize some content, you put some content in the fast lane, you by definition, at bottleneck choke points, put other content in the slow lane.
Ultimately, Professor Wu warned the Judiciary Committee that the loss of network neutrality will smother the innovative nature of the internet, which has made it such a powerful economic and social engine.
It's no longer survival of the fittest. It's no longer who has the best technology. It's a question of who goes golfing with the CEO of AT&T. And I think that's not the American way. I mean, sometimes it is, but it shouldn't be the American way.
The COPE Act is expected to come up for a full vote on the House floor sometime in May. The timetable for similar legislation in the Senate is less certain.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580, coming to you live Sunday, April 30th, 2006, from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And it's a pleasure to be here today. And this is a day, as those of you looking out your windows know, here in central Illinois, in which we have our usual spring unpredictable weather, and so we may be interrupting the show with storm warnings, so stay tuned. But otherwise, sit back and relax. We have a terrific show today for you. Our guest on the phone from New York City joining us today is Janine Jackson, the Program Director for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR. Janine's been on the show several times before, including, I think, one of our very first shows when we first went on the air just about 4 years ago. Exactly. Janine Jackson also is the editor of the FAIR Reader, an extra review of press and politics of the 1990s, published by Westview Press, and probably best known to many of you as a contributor to Extra, the bi-monthly publication of Fairness and Accuracy Reporting, and as co-host of FAIR syndicated radio talk show Counterspin, which is carried on 130 stations around the nation, and is carried on two locally, right here on WILL AM 580 every Thursday at 10:30 p.m., and on the local community station WEFT every Wednesday at 5:30 p.m. So it's a pleasure to have Janine Jackson with us. Janine, you there?
I certainly am here. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, well, it's great that you take time off on your Sunday, and it's much appreciated. And the sort of the hefty Media Matters guest paycheck will be in the mail to you.
Well, I'll look out for that, Bob.
Don't look too hard. Well, there's so much to cover, and I want to tell our listeners unfamiliar with fairness and accuracy in reporting that if you just go to the website fair.org, F-A-I-R.org, you can stay on top of what they do and learn all about FAIR and the work they do. But FAIR has been around for, if I'm not mistaken, Janine, 20 years.
20 years.
And doing fairly comprehensive media watch work on the news media primarily, though not exclusively. And what is you know, the reason FAIR exists, and what's FAIR's mission today? What sort of work does FAIR do? What's a standard month in the life of FAIR?
Well, what we do at FAIR is media criticism and activism. I always start off by explaining it that it's kind of one step further than throwing your shoes at the television. You know, basically we observe and consume news media the way that everyone does. But when we have a question, isn't there something missing? Isn't there a perspective missing from this story? Aren't we getting just half of this debate? What FAIR does is to do the research, to do the analysis of kind of what's missing from the mainstream news media that we have in newspapers, television, and radio. And the idea, and you'll have to remember that, yeah, when FAIR started in 1986, people didn't really think about media so much as a political issue. You know, if you were a little group or organization, what you basically wanted to do was get into the newspaper, you know, and that was the view of media. I think, you know, people sort of trusted news media. That's changed over time, and FAIR's work has changed with it. And one of the things that has always been key to FAIR's work is explaining to folks and illustrating the way, simply enough, the way that the structure of owning media, the way we run media as a business, the various ways that conflicts with and gets in the way of good journalism. and what we expect from good journalism in terms of serving democracy. So that kind of conflict, illuminating that conflict, talking about the impact it has on the issues that we care about, as well as, of course, talking about ways to change it, ways to fix it. That's what FAIR does. We have, as you mentioned, a radio program, a magazine called Extra, and we also have a really active listserv, what we call the Action Alert Network, where we send out alerts about particular media violations, if you will, or problems, and give people an easy way to talk back directly to news media. But what it's mainly about is what's missing, what's wrong with coverage of certain issues, and then bigger picture, what is that conflict with corporate ownership, with commercial-driven, sponsor-driven media? How does that fundamentally interfere with the process of doing and distributing really good critical journalism?
Janine Jackson, our guest today in Media Matters. Janine Jackson, the Program Director of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, generally known as FAIR, the Media Watch Group. Janine, I think FAIR in Extra and on Counterspin and in its action alerts and all its fronts that it operates has been critical of the Bush build up to eventual invasion of and now occupation of Iraq, or critical of the press coverage of it, I should say.
Absolutely.
And has been from the very beginning. And one of the striking developments in the past year or two has been the sort of mea culpas that have been issued, albeit haltingly, by some of the major media acknowledging that they sort of blew it.
Yeah.
And the press coverage leading up to the invasion of Iraq. Do you think, from your perspective, reading the news, or from FAIR's perspective, analyzing the news stories closely, that the news media have sort of internalized this criticism and have really sort of turned things around now and are far more skeptical of Bush administration claims on foreign policy?
I wish I could say that they were. Unfortunately, I can sort of illustrate that they are not with one word. Iran, you know. Mm-hmm. We now have a situation in which I think a lot of just kind of folks in the street are saying, wait a minute, are we really lining up to go to war with another country? I mean, I think we, you know, it would, under the Bush administration, there's been kind of a constant state of ricochet, if you will, or bafflement or confusion, I think, or overwhelm of what's going on. But the very fact that we're seeing media coverage even of a run-up to conflict with Iran, or the interest of this administration in sort of demonizing Iran at this moment. And I'm not saying, I'm not even going into detail about that coverage, but just the kind of generally uncritical in terms of who we're getting to hear speak about it. We're still hearing the same political insiders discuss the Iran policy. You know, we're not getting the outside voices that were the ones that turned out to be right about Iraq, about what the repercussions of that would be. So, no, I don't think. I think there have been changes, I'm sure, in the part of individual reporters. But as a whole, I see the same lack of curiosity, lack of challenge to official voices, and more fundamentally, you know, at FAIR we always, you know, we don't try to get inside journalists' head. We more look at, say, television coverage and just say, who are they allowing to speak? Who's in the conversation about this? Are we hearing from folks who are critical of the administration? Are we hearing from experts in the country that we're talking about? Are we hearing from international voices? Or are we still getting the same kind of top-down, White House-driven coverage? And unfortunately, on Iran, as well as on domestic policy issues, we're still seeing the elite media I'm talking about be pretty much led by the White House, both in terms of what they cover and who they kind of allow to speak of it. That should have been the lesson, or one of them, that came out of the Iraq War, is, you know, all the retired generals and all the administration folks that were all sort of echoing this one another and saying the same thing, turned out not to have been enough of a debate. I think whatever you think about the war, you can agree we did not have a sufficient and sufficiently informed debate about it beforehand. And I don't see that changed. I don't see that fundamentally changed, I'm very sorry to say.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Janine Jackson, the program director of FAIR, the Media Watch Group. You can learn more about FAIR by going to the webpage, fair.org, or you can listen to WILL every Thursday at 10:30 p.m., and you'll hear Counterspin, the program that FAIR produces, that Janine Jackson is the co-host of. Counterspin is also carried locally in WEFT every Wednesday at 5:30 p.m. Janine Jackson, there's been so much in the news I want to talk about that deals with the issues FAIR is concerned with bias and media coverage of issues. And one of the great issues that's really emerged on the political map, I wouldn't say out of nowhere, but it's certainly vaulted to much greater prominence in the past few weeks, has been immigration.
Absolutely.
And what is FAIR's take or your take on this issue and how it's been covered in the news media? And then in the process, let's talk a little bit about Lou Dobbs, who's getting a lot of attention on the FAIR website nowadays.
Yes, it's interesting. You know, I mean, immigration is one of the issues that makes me realize that as much as we always need to be fighting in terms of the structure of media and policy work, we really need to, alongside that, keep up this day-to-day criticism and activism around, you know, what are the conversations that media are allowing us to have on certain issues. And I think immigration is a great example where we're seeing, and I'm not sure what local media is like around the country, but even in national media and cable news, some really hateful and angry rhetoric and anti-immigrant conversation and talk, and it's really disturbing because I think immigration is an issue where lots of well-intentioned and intelligent people disagree. You know, it needs to be a fairly subtle and informed conversation. And I think however you come at the issue, if you turn on the television, what you are not seeing is a subtle and nuanced and well-informed and inclusive conversation. One of the problems is that one of the very few voices that has been talking about immigration for a while and talking about is putting it mildly has been CNN's Lou Dobbs. As you say, for many people and many in the press, it sort of seems like these marches and these big demonstrations have sort of blossomed up from nowhere, and this issue politically was not something that people were necessarily thinking about as a major policy issue just a couple of years ago. Of course, some people always have, but media certainly were not. But there's always been Lou Dobbs, who has been using his CNN program, Lou Dobbs Tonight, for a long time now to really beat a drum about what he, you know, very comfortably refers to as illegal aliens, you know, that's the riff night after night. And it's fascinating because Lou Dobbs is somebody who people have a lot of interesting and conflicting feelings about. People think it's terrific that he talks about corporate outsourcing, that he seems to be talking from a worker's perspective on some issues. But I think you're not getting the full picture unless you turn it on those nights when he's talking about the invasion of illegal aliens that's threatening the health of Americans by importing leprosy into this country. You know, this is one of the programs that Lou Dobbs has done. And he's really on a roll about it. He does it really virtually every night on his program, but he doesn't do it in a way that allows people to hear lots of different sides on the issue. He admits, and in fact he was on Reliable Sources, CNN's media show with Howard Kurtz, and I have the quote here. He said, "I'm not interested. Are you interested in 6 or 7 views, or are you interested in the truth? Because that's what I'm interested in. That's what my viewers are interested in." In other words, here's someone presuming, you know, CNN is presenting it as journalism, and he's saying, "I'm just going to present one point of view on this very thorny issue of immigration, and I'm not interested in what anybody else has to say." That, to us, is very distressing, particularly, you know, coming back to where I started, which was that Lou Dobbs is one of the few people who really has been talking about immigration for some time now, not a great flagship on the issue.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Janine Jackson. If you'd like to call in and speak with Janine Jackson with a question or comment, the phone number here is 1-800-222-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. In the next couple of weeks here on Media Matters, our guest will be Tim Carr next week, and we'll be talking about the raging battle over net neutrality on Capitol Hill that FAIR has been involved with. In 2 weeks from today, the novelist and writer Walter Mosley will be our guest here on Media Matters. So please be certain to stay tuned to the program for the next 2 weeks. We've got some great shows for you. Our guest today, again, is Janine Jackson, the Program Director of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the Media Watch Group, also known as FAIR, and the co-host of Counterspin, the terrific weekly radio program which can be heard right here on WIL every Thursday at 10:30 p.m. or on the local community station WEFT, WEFT, Wednesdays at 5:30 p.m. Janine Jackson, we've been talking about the press coverage of immigration and Lou Dobbs on CNN. Another bit of news that has happened in the past week has been that Tony Snow of Fox News has now sort of changed hats, so to speak, and gone from Fox News to work for the Bush administration. What's your response to that?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it seems just like a change of offices. He was doing a pretty good job for the Bush administration over at Fox News, I thought. You know, to me, it's a prime example of a kind of revolving door between government and journalism. You would think that many journalists would never in a million years consider going to be a mouthpiece for a state, for a government. You know, it would be the last thing that as an independent kind of critical muckraking journalist that you would do. It would be your nightmare, not your dream. So, you know, whatever on that level, I think it's just an interesting choice, but it does say something that we have a national news network in this country that an administration, a particularly polarizing administration, would see as kind of a great, training league for somebody who could come and work for them and represent their views, as I say, just more directly. So I guess I'm a little surprised because you would think that the White House would want to find someone outside kind of someone with no history that people knew, someone that people had not seen night after night on the news, but you know, this administration surprises us all the time. What is curious to me and what I'm curious to see is journalists, as we know, often operate with a kind of pack mentality. And I think we've already seen, I heard George Stephanopoulos talking about this on ABC's This Week, a kind of feeling that, hey, this is almost one of us. He's a reporter. Maybe this will make it easier for us in the White House to get along with him. That's, again, worrisome to me because you don't really necessarily want a friendly buddy-buddy relationship there. You want journalists to be really asking this guy tough questions and not sort of, you know, remembering hanging out with him, you know. I'm curious about what the kind of insider, Tony Snow's inside status, how that will shift things maybe in terms of those press conferences.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Janine Jackson, the Program Director of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Before we go to our first caller on the lines, let me make this announcement about the weather. A severe thunderstorm watch is in effect for Champaign, Christian, Coles, Cumberland, DeWitt, Douglas, Logan, Macon, Moultrie, Piatt, Sangamon, and Shelby counties until 7 o'clock tonight. A severe thunderstorm watch is in effect for much of our listening area, most of central Illinois. So be careful, stay tuned, and keep an eye on the weather if you're listening. Now let's go to our phone lines. Again, if you'd like to call in to speak with Janine Jackson, the phone number here at Media Matters at WILL AM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with Janine Jackson.
Hi. I wanted to get you to talk about one of your recent action alerts, the one about the Washington Post editorial titled "A Good Leak."
Because right.
I hit the ceiling, and I guess people did. I see that Robert Perry on Consortium News has done a really lengthy study of what the Washington Post was doing. We've had a lot of talk about the New York Times and Judy Miller and all that, but the Post is, I was just absolutely shocked. They even picked up the rift about all of the misleading that that Wilson was doing, attacked him in the editorial. It was really rather astonishing. So I'd like for you to talk about that at some length if you have the time. And then there's another thing I've thought about doing, which is pitching a good reporting outside of the newspaper of record. I was really impressed by a Chicago Tribune, investigative journalism story about the kind of things that the U.S. and U.S. corporations are doing in Iraq, almost kidnapping people from South Asia to work in Iraq. There's a story about Nepalese being told they were going to work in a five-star hotel in you know the story. Well,
yeah,
anyway,
horrific. Yes,
it was an amazing piece, and they just had it on the front page this past week, a continuation of the story. I think it's good to credit some of the good journalism that gets done now and again too. But a good leak, if you would, thank you.
Yeah, and Janine, before you discuss a good leak, if you could give a little background for
Absolutely.
Some of our listeners who wouldn't be familiar with what he's talking about.
And truthfully, you know, the Judy Miller, Joseph Wilson stuff, even if you're following it day to day, it's really not easy to keep up with. In this case, I think, let me first say, I want to underscore his second point. And sometimes when we talk, Bob, I know that people can hear us as saying media are terrible, there isn't anything good. I absolutely agree that there's good journalism going on out there and that it should be credited, you know, that credit should be given, absolutely. There are a lot of things we would just never know if it weren't for those hardworking journalists, even on the Iraq War.
Didn't Extra just recently have an article praising a number of great journalists for their coverage?
It's been so galling to hear people say everyone got it wrong on Iraq, because not everyone did. There were journalists at Knight Ridder, for example, who really were asking the hard questions. And, you know, it's no good to erase them. You know, we really have to honor them and remember that, you know, some people were asking questions. They simply weren't being picked up by the general media chorus. And in the case of what the caller is asking about, this recent Washington Post editorial called A Good Leak, it's actually the same thing, because the reporters at the Washington Post had written a very good news story about some of the ins and outs of this case, about leaking Libby, as we know, leaking the information that Joseph Wilson, who was a critic of the administration, that his wife was a CIA agent. Now, I'm not going to go into the chapter and the verse of it, because frankly, I'll get tangled up myself. But basically, it has to do with whether something called the National Intelligence Estimate supported Joseph Wilson's claims that the claim that Iraq was trying to buy uranium from Niger, that this was not something that was generally believed, that this did not have a lot of support. That was what the National Intelligence Estimate said. It did not support the White House's claims about uranium. It did tend, you could say it tended to back up what Joseph Wilson had said. But you have to say that it found no support for these charges, that Iraq was, it did not underscore that Iraq, or prove that Iraq was trying to buy uranium from Niger. In fact, it said quite the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's what the Washington Post news story said, but the Washington Post editorial seemed to go absolutely the other way. In fact, it said, and I have the quote, it said, "The material that Mr. Bush ordered declassified established, as have several subsequent investigations, that Mr. Wilson was the one guilty of twisting the truth. In fact, his report supported the conclusion that Iraq had sought uranium." Now, this is just inaccurate. You know, the National Intelligence Estimate didn't really support Wilson, but it did not support the White House either. I mean, that's sort of the truth of it. Here is the editorial coming flat out and saying that this material says that Joseph Wilson was guilty of twisting the truth. It's simply not the case, and we were very confused by it, because it doesn't really comport with information that not just the Washington Post has reported, but that other outlets have reported too, you know, that there was not a lot of support in the administration, that people did think it simply wasn't true, that the documents that it was based on were forgeries, that a lot of this was known before Colin Powell went to the UN. You know, there's a lot of backstory that people can read, but suffice to say, the general understanding was that they knew what they were doing,
mm-hmm.
you know. So anyway, you have a situation here where the Washington Post is basically out White Housing the White House. You
mm-hmm.
know, they're supporting a claim that the White House itself has backed off from, which is just very, very strange. You know, the White House itself has come forward and said they don't have grounds for this claim. You know, so for the Washington Post to be not just making that claim in an editorial, but then supporting it and, you know, in response to the activism and complaints about it, not backing off from it and sort of saying, well, people can disagree. And Fair's line on it has been, on all of this Judy Miller, Joseph Wilson stuff, you can have your own opinion, but you can't have your own facts, you know? Mm-hmm. So the problem with the editorial was a factual problem and not that we felt that it came down on the wrong side of things or we didn't like the attitude it presented. It was really just they weren't getting the facts that in the very same day, their very same reporters were in fact telling straight the editorial page was somehow, I don't know, maybe they don't read their own paper.
You're listening to Janine Jackson, my guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our phone number here, if you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Janine Jackson, is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We have a couple of very patient callers on the lines. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Janine Jackson of FAIR.
Oh, hi, Janine. What a great question from the first caller, and thank you for your extended answer.
I wish I could have been more illuminating. I let me direct folks to FAIR.org, and they can read a much less garbled explanation of that whole story, but thank you.
All right. I've got two somewhat general and lighter questions, and I'll start with the lightest, I suppose. How would you place Denny the Dissector Schechter on the totem of great media critics like yourself and Dr. Bob McChesney, along with a host of others? Question two, and is there a change in the specific gravity of the influence upon the working class of all of your great, fine, and tireless work? And please feel free to be critical. It's a call from an old lefty. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, before you answer those, I don't think Danny Schechter will like hearing that his question is sort of the light one, knowing Danny as we do. But while you're talking about Danny, I think that leads to a question I wanted to talk to you about, which is, this since FAIR has come along, as you said, really pioneered in many ways media criticism in the United States, absolutely pioneered it in many ways, at least popular media criticism, non-academic. What about groups like David Brock's Media Matters for America? How do they relate to a group like FAIR? How do you two work together or complement each other? And then where does Danny Schechter fit into the picture?
Well, our basic feeling on media criticism and media activism, which are often related, is the more the merrier. You know, FAIR is always excited to see new groups grow up I was about to say Danny Schechter is not new, but I don't think he would like that either. but a group like Media Matters is a terrific addition to the scene, I think, to the landscape. I would say that I think they're more clearly identified with the Democratic Party, for example, than FAIR would be, but that's just a difference of political shading, and basically I look at a media criticism group in terms of what's the research that they do? Do they make their case? Do they make their argument? I find lots of information that's tremendously useful from Media Matters, where they've collected sites and collected examples and illustrations of problems that we've noted ourselves, and I'd like to think that they get information that's helpful from us or sort of tips for things to look into from us, So my feeling on that is just the more the merrier, and of all kinds of political persuasions.
Now, as for the second question the caller had, this actually, I don't know if the caller was aware of this, but your beat at FAIR for the time you've been there, to my knowledge, has always been to cover the coverage of the economy and the coverage of labor and social inequality more than anything else. And you have a new article out on media coverage of the state of the economy dealing with a lot of these issues about the class relations and treatment of labor. So why don't you talk a little bit about, the general problem with our news media there and then specifically what's going on today?
Well, I think looking at coverage of the economy is one of the clearest ways to illustrate that media, major media in this country, are not liberal, that tired old argument, But it's so striking to me how really, I really want to say anti-democratic the coverage of the economy has been. And I think is in general. It's so incredibly top down, when we talk about the impact of policies or different things coming out of the White House or different laws, it's so difficult to really find consistently any attention to the impact on regular working people. Even when media try to talk about regular working people, it's someone who makes $200,000 a year, you know, even when you get the feeling they're making an effort. It's just such a pyramid-shaped, you know, view of the economy, and it's really remarkable. I think just lately we've seen something where the press corps really seemed to have come detached from reality. And that is the thing that I just wrote about in the April issue of Extra. You know, the Bush administration has been making a real concerted effort to say the economy is booming, the economy is doing fantastic, the economy is really strong. And the reason, of course, that they're doing that is that opinion polls show that people are unhappy with the economy and with their own economic future. People are depressed about it. So here you have a situation where the White House is trying to change people's feelings about the economy, not change the economy. And what do media do? But they simply act as though it's a mystery to them why, given that the economy is so good, why it is that people don't believe it's good, you know? Mm-hmm. And you have a problem from the outset. You want to say, well, why are you second-guessing people's own assessment of their economic situation? You know, why is the story, what's wrong with people? What's wrong with people's brains, you know? And why is the story not what really is the economic reality that's being faced by most people? And, of course, as, you know, your listeners know, we have seen GDP growth go up in this country, but that's gone largely into corporate profits and into CEOs' pockets, and it hasn't really trickled down, to use that expression. You know, the growth, what's called economic growth in the media, has not meant the growth of wages or of incomes of most people. It simply hasn't. It's not a question of spin. You know, that's simply the reality, that wages and incomes for average workers, when you adjust them for inflation, are either stagnant or down in recent years. And it's been really kind of remarkable to me to see big media not engage that fact, but instead come up with kind of a long list of explanations for why people are just so darn confused about it, you know. And one of the formulations we've seen was the Wall Street Journal was saying that, well, people must have a negative view of the economy because it's just spillover from concerns about the Iraq war, you know, that somehow people's concerns about the war makes them confused about whether or not they actually can pay their heating bill, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, this just weird kind of elitist guessing. And in fact, there was just an example, the Newsweek that's on the stands right now has a story about George W. Bush's popularity, and they just take it as a given that the economy is great. They say, you know, he just can't get a break, this guy, Bush. You know, he can't get a break even when things go his way. And their example is, economists say the economy is strong. Bush should be enjoying the credit for that. But instead, polls show voters believe things are still sluggish. Newsweek's reason, that's largely because gas prices are so high. Well, you know, again, gas prices are high, but that's not confusing people about their general economic situation. People think their wages aren't going up because their wages aren't going up. So I think it's so, you know, if we really had a liberal media, we would not have our major news outlets ignoring the economic reality of most Americans in order to share with the White House this confusion about why people don't seem to understand that they're doing well.
You're listening to Janine Jackson, my guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Janine Jackson's the Program Director of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the Media Watch Group. You can learn more about FAIR on the website, fair.org. Also, listen to Janine Jackson's radio program, which FAIR produces, Counterspin, which is aired weekly here on WILL at Thursdays at 10:30 p.m. Also locally on WEFT, Wednesday at 5:30 p.m., our local community radio station. We have lines open if people want to call in at 333-9455. And our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We have a caller patiently waiting to, I'll get to in a second. But first, I want to follow up on your last answer, Janine. You mentioned the coverage of Bush in the latest Newsweek. Bush's popularity ratings by all polls now across the political spectrum, whatever the viewpoints of the pollster, now approaching all-time record lows for a sitting president. And, you know, we were told in the first term of President Bush, especially following 9/11, that, you know, the reason why the news media were especially generous to President Bush and allowed him to dominate the news cycle and set the tone and really almost have a royal coverage in the press was that he was so popular in the polls that journalists were afraid to do anything that might suggest he was anything short of infallible. Now, of course, they have the polls saying that very few people think he's infallible. Most Americans are ready to throw him overboard. Has this given the journalists and the news media, has it turned them into voracious critics, do you think?
Well, you know, I think we have seen, with both the sinking of the popularity of the Iraq War and the sinking of the popularity of George W. Bush, I believe we have seen journalists with a little more confidence to say some of the critical things that they ought to have been saying for as long as those things have been true. You know, I do think we see journalists a little more confident to be critical, to be doing regular old challenging journalism. It hasn't changed. That's still kind of around the edges, though. It hasn't really changed the general thrust of coverage, the general tone of coverage, and the general shape of the debate. And, you know, it's interesting the way you set it up, you know, that there was, the journalists would point to opinion polls. I find that so disingenuous, the way media use and abuse public opinion to justify whatever the heck it is that they want to do. You know, there are a majority of Americans who would support universal health care and have been saying that for years and years now, perhaps decades now, and yet that idea can't get arrested in mainstream media. And yet, when they want to do something silly or do some sensational story, they say, well, you know, we really don't want to do it, but the public is really interested in it, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I take with the largest possible grain of salt. And anytime I hear a journalist pointing to public opinion as a justification or as a reason for what stories they are and aren't covering, I begin laughing immediately, you know?
But Janine, why do you think that, you know, when Bill Clinton had his relationship with Monica Lewinsky, in his term, and Fair was by no means a supporter of the Clinton administration, I don't think, if one looks back at their work. If that took place and there was extraordinary press coverage of it, it really took over the political culture in this country for a year. And recently now in the Bush administration, there are credible arguments that President Bush has done impeachable offenses made by a lot of very serious observers. Matt Rothschild, who was on this show a few weeks ago, I think outlined four distinct high crimes and misdemeanors that would justify impeachment. But it's barely gotten a smidgen of attention in the news media. I mean, it gets less attention than, you know, when Paris Hilton goes shopping.
Well, two things. One thing is, I think we cannot deny the general, what I would call center-right tone of corporate-owned media, which is that it's not full of progressive or critical people, period. You know, it's peopled with status quo supporters and with tending over to the right. And that's mainstream media. And then we have seen in the last 10 years or more is a creation of a right-wing media machine, you know, with Fox News, with the Washington Times. There's really been an industry created there whose perhaps main effect has been to push mainstream media even further to the right, to increase that feeling that mainstream journalists have, I would say, virtually always had, at least for the last, you know, 20 years that Fair's been around, this feeling of looking over your shoulder and out of fear of being called liberal, you know. So I think there's just something that tends towards more support for Republican administrations and for Clinton for many people was very close to Republican on many issues, you know, but I think there is just a rightward tendency that we can't deny. I want to say something else, though, which is that I somehow believe that it's genuinely easier for journalists to talk about adultery, to talk about sex, and even to wring their hands and act in high dudgeon about it, than it is to really engage the kind of deep-going, serious, fundamental corruptions of democracy that are going on in this administration. In other words, I think that mainstream media one of their definitions is a kind of fealty to the system, you know. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to challenge everything at once, I think there is a kind of, no, we mustn't upend the whole card table, you know. We really want to say that we have a system that works, that, in other words, things cannot be as wrong as some people want to say they are. I think there is a kind of safeness in that for mainstream media that is even that goes beyond a lot of other things, and that goes some way towards explaining why it was okay to talk about Bill Clinton in a way that it is not okay to talk about George W. Bush.
Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 4, Park Forest, you're on the air with Janine Jackson.
Yes, thank you. I did miss parts of the conversation in and out of the car, but I pretty much got the gist of most of it. One thing that I, as just a plain, ordinary citizen, not involved in anything in particular, was very upset with, and I was a pretty faithful listener to Charlie Rose for over the years, and I was terribly incensed when Tom Friedman would come on at the beginning of the Iraq War and carry on and carry on and carry on how, oh, we had to do this, blah, 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 and then in the last year or perhaps a little bit longer than that, has decided, oh, he was wrong. And, you know, this is where people get their media information, or they pretty much assume that if you're with the New York Times and if you're on Charlie Rose, what you are saying must be right. Although I will say that Mr. Rose always would come back with questioning people. He didn't just leave things slide by. That was one thing pertaining to part of your first conversation. The other thing is I'm on a semi-crusade, something that should be looked at in the media and isn't, and in the health field, is this thing called high fructose corn syrup. There was a very good article in the ART Bulletin back in April of 2004, which explains it thoroughly as to the fact that why it is a has pushed up the obesity problem and the diabetes problem. As I say, the April issue of 2004 ART Bulletin. Plus, there is a book that was written in 2003 called Fat Land, How Americans Became the Fattest People in the World. It's by a Greg, I believe it's C-R-I-T-S-E-R, which was written.
Caller, I think before we go through the bibliography on this issue, maybe is there a question connected to it?
Well, I'm just hoping, I suppose I'm hoping, and the question is there should be more out on in the media on this issue since it's become such a big problem in the country.
Indeed it has, and thank you very much for calling. So Janine Jackson from FAIR, first
sure.
part, Tom Friedman, mea culpa-ing his way through that war.
Well, and Francis Fukuyama is another one. It's fascinating. It really tells you, again, that, you know, how do mainstream media, how do they pick their experts? How do they justify having the same people? And Friedman, of course, you know, he's not on Charlie Rose because he doesn't have an outlet. You know, he has a column in the New York Times. So if you're going to bring him on to public broadcasting, is it because he's so insightful, because he's so often right? Well, it turns out no, you know, and it's been very interesting to see that all of these people who got it so wrong somehow are the same experts that we're going to have tell us about everything else that's going on. In other words, not only have they not been called to account for, you know, how did you get this wrong? Were you misinformed? Were you listening to the wrong people? Do you still listen to those people who misinformed you before? You know, it's just kind of, you know, well, hey, you were wrong about that. You win some, you lose some, you know, which is very dispiriting and it is very disrespectful, of course, to an audience that is turning on the news hoping that people are there for a reason and that that reason is expertise and not that they're good friends and they're at the New York Times and so, of course, they're going to get on public broadcasting whatever they say and no matter how correct it is, you know. Certainly we see those of us who work with smaller groups, who work with labor groups or environmental groups,
we're often told, you know, you have to have all your facts right or you're going to be left out of the discussion. You know, you have to really do your homework.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you don't get everything right, you're not going to be invited back. You know, it seems that the higher you get, the lower a standard you're held to, you know. And, you know, it's
actually, C. Wright Mills called that the higher immorality.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. I mean, it's fascinating. It's just kind of, it really gives you the feeling, you know, at FAIR we always say that there's no need to picture a smoke-filled room, you know, that the problems that we're talking about don't have to be conspiracy. What you do get a feeling, though, is a cocktail party, you know, is of folks who they sort of know who it's okay to talk to, who their friends are, and it's going to be those same people. It doesn't really matter whether they've gotten their facts right or whether they've been completely wrong. And then again, the Thomas Friedmans, they don't seem humbled, you know. Here are things that they have declared to be, you know, categorically true that have not just turned out to be false, but their falseness has resulted in death.
Yeah, catastrophically false.
You know, and to sort of say, well, ha-ha, I'm on to the next thing, you
mm-hmm.
know, is just, it chills your heart.
Now, the second part of her question, and I didn't mean to cut her off, but I do, no. We only have so much time left. I know you have written, I want to preface this by saying that for the last 6 years, FAIR has done an annual report that you've been co-author of called Fear and Favor.
Right.
Dealing with commercial and political pressures on newsrooms and citing, you know, example after example of how advertisers or owners or government officials or PR agencies have shaped and warped the news unbeknownst to the general public. And this seems like the sort of case where you have an enormous industry that makes a lot of money serving highly fattening foods, sugary foods, corn syrup laden foods to the American people. Does this affect the way people learn about these issues?
Well, you've said exactly what I was going to say, which
great
is
minds
that
think alike.
Well, in fact, I as the caller was talking, I thought I just read something about high fructose corn syrup and how the industry essentially had a choice of which way they could go, you know, in determining what ingredients to put in, and that it was basically industry pressure that made them go with this decision that they did, even though it's turned out to be, and it's largely, of course, in sodas, you know, it's turned out to be much more fattening and much more, you know, health destructive. And it's a clear example, first of all, of industry influence on policy and on our health. But then the fact that there was, I don't remember any discussion about it really in the media about, you know, there's going to be a decision about every soda the content of every soda you drink. You know, maybe health groups, maybe you want to know about it. I don't remember that conversation. A decision was just kind of reached. And as you say, the reporting on these things is always going to be hobbled by the fact that the same people, certainly when you're talking about soda, certainly when you're talking about sugar and corn syrup, the same people who are involved in that industry are some of the biggest advertisers that news media have. And we know that as much as we like journalists to be independent, in fact, news media is, commercial news media, of course, is beholden to its advertisers, and you're not going to get very far writing story after story that's critical of the corn syrup industry.
We've only got a few minutes left in the show. We have a couple callers who've been very patient. Let's hope we can get through both of them if they'll keep their questions as short as possible. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with Janine Jackson of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Line one, are you there?
Hello?
Hello, yes. Go ahead, sir.
I have one question.
Okay.
Why is it that everybody seems to think that the economy is in such good condition? Why don't we look at it with a deduction for the cost of the war in Iraq and all the milling around associated therewith?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, he's getting at a key point, which is that I'm talking about the spin that different people can put on the economic numbers. The truth is the numbers themselves often need to be unpacked and need to be explored, because the White House, and not just this White House, but any White House, will put out information and say, well, here's the national debt, or here is the growth rate. Oh, we've separated out the costs of the war, you know, and you and I can't you know, figure out how to do that math and put that back together, but we know we're missing some information. And data like gross domestic product. You know, that you hear that in virtually every story to prove that the economy is good, but that just essentially means the pie is bigger. It doesn't really tell you anything about the way the pie is cut up and distributed. So the caller is right. It's not just you know, who says these numbers are good, who says they're bad. You really have to look at the numbers themselves and whether or not they're really telling you, are they really telling you what the economy is like for working people? Often they're not. Numbers don't really mean anything in isolation, which is why it's so critical to have a real debate about them and a real range of voices talking about them.
Let's go back to the phone lines for our final caller here in Media Matters. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Janine Jackson.
My comment is my own little bit of personal media criticism. In all the discussion of changing the anchor in CBS Evening News and moving somebody into the Today Show, all of it was about improved advertising markets, increasing viewership, and no talk at all about improved broadcast journalism. And I think that fits right in with what you've been saying.
Thank you, caller. Janine?
Absolutely right. You know, and the discussion, I mean, first of all, on one level, how sad was it to see people, you know, ringing the bells because maybe there's going to be a woman anchoring a network news show? I mean, it is 2006, people, you know. But also, be that as it may, I the caller is right. The coverage that I saw was like, is this, will Katie Couric bring up the ratings of this network? What will happen to the ratings at the Today Show? And there really wasn't. In terms of content, it was really, is Katie Couric too perky to be taken seriously? That was kind of as deep as it went. And what is that but a sign of really, on some levels, the joke that has been made of the very, very important function of the nightly news?
Janine Jackson, we've only got a few seconds left, and a caller emailed in wondering where you get your news. What's your news diet look like on a daily basis?
Well, because what we're doing is criticizing mainstream news, a lot of what we do is reading mainstream news, which, again, points out the fact that we get some critical information there. If you read all the way through the paper, you're going to find some hard-hitting, some critical stories that will at least lead you elsewhere, even in elite media.
What's your favorite mainstream news?
Oh, dear.
Is that an awful question?
That's an you know, I honestly don't like any of them to call enough to call them my favorite. I will say that I start off the day with the New York Times because that's just how it is. And, gee, they do an excellent crossword puzzle. Can I say that?
On that note, I think I want to thank you, Janine Jackson, so much for joining us today in Media Matters. Janine Jackson, the Program Director of FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. You can learn about them on the website, fair.org. Go there. And her program, which she co-hosts, Counterspin, is heard here on WILL AM 580 every Thursday night at 10:30 p.m. My name's Bob McChesney. I'll see you in 167 hours. Thanks to my producer, Andrew Boyle, my technical director, Brett Polson. Have a great week.